Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 5, delivered on September 5, 2012. The title of this lecture is Open Market Operations.
Today, Open Market Operations. Now, to begin this lecture, I'll do a little bit of review. I was not quite sure where I finished in the last lecture since I came here on Monday and, you know, there was no one here, and then I finally realized, you know, really? So I have to back up a little bit here, make sure you all remember the happy times we had as a family together when last we were together. The Federal Reserve System is the controller of monetary policy in the United States. Theoretically non-political, non-partisan, the Board of Governors has three, the Federal Reserve has three jobs. As I told you before, one is that it is, one of its jobs is to regulate and supervise the banking system. Unfortunately, not all banks are under the Federal Reserve's control. Some banks are regulated at the state level, some banks are regulated at the by the FDIC, other banks are regulated by other entities. And there are non-bank entities as well, which I'll bring up in a little while, credit unions, SNLs, and all that. But the Federal Reserve has three jobs. First, regulate and supervise the banks that are under its authority. The second is that it serves as a bank for banks in competition with private commercial banks that do the banking services for banks. And third, it conducts monetary policy. That third role is a powerful role that affects the economy in enormous, significant ways. Conducts monetary policy. Now, before I go too far with this, third role, third job of the Fed, I need to talk about money. And to do that, I should probably start, Madam, what is money?
Something you use to buy something.
Okay, that's not bad. You actually have captured part of it, an important aspect of it. It is something that we use in transactions. Now, I can start with a term. First of all, money is actually anything that is accepted by parties in a transaction. If, for example, we are cave people, you have killed a moose, I made an apple pie. Now, you could say apple pie, I could say moose, we trade, money was involved, moose money or pie money. One or the other. We'd have to use one as the base currency. But whatever is accepted in transactions, that really is money. Now, let me detail that a little more. Money serves three purposes. First of all, the functions of money. Money is, first of all, a medium of exchange. It is a way that we can get something of value transferred for another thing of value. It's just some way that we can get a trade to happen. It is also a store of value. Now, some money is a better store of value than other money. A moose gets old real fast when it's dead. But there are other things where you could put away, and instead of having to use it right now, you could hold it for a while and use it later. So some money has better store of value than other money. A dollar bill, if you try to keep it for a couple of decades, it might get kind of crappy. But a gold coin might be able to hold value better over a period of time, store of value. And then it is also a unit of account so that we can keep track of things of value, how much we have, or how much one thing is for another thing. Now, there are three different levels of money. The most primitive kind of money. The most primitive kind of money is barter money. Now, barter money is characterized by the fact that the money itself can be used as a consumption item. Moose, I can eat. Okay? Dollar bill, I can't. So that's not a barter money. Gold, I can't really use all that well, but I could use it. Barter money is characterized by the fact that the thing itself, the thing we're using for money, you could use it, you could consume it instead. Primitive monies are like that. The second level of money is commodity money, or sometimes what some writers and economists and financial people call metal money. Now, both barter and metal money have value in and of themselves, intrinsic value. Barter money has perfect intrinsic value. I can eat a moose. Perfect. Gold is a metal money. It has intrinsic value. You can make things with gold. I can make a very pretty filigree or something like that. But it's not quite as consumable. Metal monies do have intrinsic value, but that's mostly cultural. A lot of their value is just gold is important, gold is beautiful, platinum. Sometimes copper is a metal money, but it is quite useful in and of itself, aside from money purposes. So commodity money still carry intrinsic value, but not as perfectly as barter money does. And finally, the highest level of money, what is called fiat money or fiat money. This is money that is money only by decree of an authority. Money that is decree only by an authority. It has no intrinsic value whatsoever. So, this $5 bill is fiat money. It has no use. I suppose you could use it for toilet paper, something like that. But it really has no value in and of itself. Now, interestingly enough, before your time, the money had at the top of it silver certificate. A dollar bill didn't say Federal Reserve note. It said silver certificate because it could be turned into silver. Quarters were made of silver. Therefore, a dollar could become four silver objects. It had intrinsic value then. It could become a commodity money. But now, you can't trade this. It is not automatically exchangeable at a fixed value for a commodity money. You can turn it into other stuff, but in and of itself, it is not worth anything. That's fiat money. The only reason it has value is because the government tells us it does. We cannot say no to this money. That means that it is only by authority that we accept it. But remember, really anything is money if it is accepted in a transaction. Anything is money. So in your world, the world that is coming, the concept of money that has been around for a long time, for more than a century, that's going to go away. You're going to see monies that don't look like money. You're going to live in worlds of business where there are things that don't have any relationship to money that you think of as money that are very much money. It's happening all over the world now. Even the very largest houses, brokerage houses, banks are beginning to reserve monies in relatively small amounts still, but they're reserving monies that really don't look like money at all. Virtual monies like Bitcoin and all of that, because they are really accepted in transactions. They are therefore a money. They're kind of a wild west of money because there's not central authority controlling them, but there you go. Now I'm going to bring up a term that's important. Liquidity. 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 Wait a minute. You know what? Give me a second. Liquidity. I'm better. Liquidity is the efficiency. Liquidity is the efficiency, or you could put in parentheses, the ease with which one asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency or ease with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Madam, you see this $5 bill? I can turn this into cheeseburgers like a boss. I go up to the window at Wendy's and I say, I got a $5 bill, I want a double cheeseburger. And I own that shit. You, madam, are an asset. No, get that. Oh, you beast. But you see, I can't turn you into a cheeseburger real fast. You can't turn yourself into a cheeseburger real fast. But you can turn yourself into a cheeseburger. No, I don't mean with an industrial strength grinder either. You can go to work, do a couple hours, get paid for them, and then go out and buy a cheeseburger with it. So you really do have an aspect of you that can be turned into another asset. Your work product for a burger, maybe fries, you know, a soft drink on the side. But it doesn't happen quickly. It's a slow process. So in other words, I would say that this fiat money I showed you has high liquidity. But it's not, but you as an individual are every bit an asset, but the conversion to another asset would be more difficult. So you would have low liquidity, your productive capacity. Similarly, you could have a house, has a lot of value in it, but to convert it to something else would take a process. You'd have to go through the sale of it and all that. So if you were dying of hunger, you're going to die before you get that house to turn into a cheeseburger. You see, this idea of liquidity is important because in the world of finance, we care about the relative liquidities of the assets we hold in our portfolio. You will have some assets that will be highly liquid. Your cash balances, your marketable securities will have some. As we go down a balance sheet, literally, have you guys had your accounting yet? You still seem kind of normal. But okay, as you go down, remember that current assets side of the balance sheet and then the long-term assets. As you go down line to line, literally you're looking at less and less liquidity. Remember the first line on the short-term assets side with the cash, and then you had the accounts receivable, which you can sell within a few days to one of these companies that buys them. Then you had inventory. That sucks. It's really hard to get rid of your inventory. You have to sell it. That really is a pain in the butt, trust me. You know, inventory, you mean I have to sell it to make money? Jeez. And then you go down to the longer term assets like your factories and your plant and equipment. Those still have liquidity, but it's extremely low liquidity. You would have to really take a while to turn that into money, either through production or through sale. So this idea of liquidity pervades our thinking in finance. Now, the two most liquid assets that we can think of would be cash, that's dollars, and treasury bills. Those we consider to be perfect substitutes, almost perfect substitutes, because they both can be liquidated very rapidly. Go underneath that, though, and then you're getting into less and less liquidity. And so we have to recognize when we talk about money, it's more nuanced than what you would have the common person think. Well, I know what money is. I'm looking at it right here. Well, no, because money has different tiers of liquidity. Now, at the first level, when I talk about money in the sense of money, like we think about it normally, we have to look at that kind of money. We would list that as M0. That is the base money supply. That is nothing but dollars and coins. The base money supply. Now, interestingly, in most conversations in finance and economics, we don't talk too much about M0. We keep an eye on it. It did some really, really weird things a couple of years ago that had me even scratching my head, and I know everything. But we don't, in general, talk about this base money. We add a few other things to it to beef it up to the first one that we care about in our economy, which would be M1. This is very liquid money. This is cash and treasury bills, pretty much. Cash and treasury bills. Might have a few, but mostly also demand deposits. So what I'm going to put here is cash and demand deposits. So in other words, M1 is M0 plus this thing right here, demand deposits. Now these build up. Our liquidity construct of money is a hierarchy. Each higher level of money includes the next lower level in it. Now, let me make a point about demand deposits. They are the checking account money in real banks. Because theoretically, you can go in and demand that money. If you write a check, the bearer of that check should be able to go in and demand that money, and it will be honored immediately. That's what we mean by demand deposits. All the money in checking accounts. Okay, now, let me make a point about that. If you've got a checking account with a credit union, that's not a demand deposit. It's called a negotiable order of withdrawal account, a NOW account. Because theoretically, a credit union does not have to honor the demand for the money. Not right away. It can hold it. If you take a check that is written against a credit union account to that credit union and say, this check was written to me, I'd like the money for it, they don't have to honor it right there. They will, but they don't have to. Theoretically, that is not required. They can hold your check. They can say, we'll hold it, and then we'll satisfy it in 3 days or whatever. They generally would not do that. If you go to your credit union and put your ATM card in, your money comes right back out. That does not mean that they have to do that. Negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, which are what credit unions have, are not checking accounts in the bank sense. That does not mean that there's some imperfection in them. Credit unions are great, but know the difference. And we have to make that distinguishing difference when we talk about money supply. Money supply, for our purposes at M1, is cash money and bank checking deposits. As a matter of fact, and I don't know whether this rule is still in place, but at a bank, your check is spelled C-H-E-C-K. If it is at a credit union, it's not spelled the same way. That was historically required. I should also point out that M1 includes one other kind of weird thing in it, too, that used to be very more significant than it is now. But M1 used to include traveler's checks because they were so highly liquid. They were so highly liquid. Those are still in M1, although they're not nearly as big as they used to be. Although, have any of you ever used traveler's checks, taking those with you to another country? Yeah, they're still really nice because, I mean, if you lose them, you can get your money back. It's that liquid. Okay. But again, note that negotiable order of withdrawal now, money, is not part of M1. Now we go to the next level, M2. M2 has all of M1 in it, plus it has the nows and small-time deposits, like CDs, that you can get out, but you are punished a little bit if you try to get it out before it is mature. Now, by small, I'm not really sure what the number is they use these days. I'm thinking it's up to $10 million, something like that, small-time deposits. This is money that is not really liquid. This is money that is pretty liquid. For all intents and purposes, it's perfectly liquid. And then M2 also includes all of the much more liquid monies in it. And again, notice that I'm slowly pulling you into a sense of money that is different from what the average person would imagine. I'm going to start to bring this down so that I can show you something here. I ask you to suffer with me while in a moment, I'll have to sort of prowl around to find this. Now, while I'm finishing up, you're going to see that most books in finance, economics, and fields of and even accounting stop these days at M2. They say, well, that's the last one. In fact, there is another one. There are actually two more, one of which is extraordinarily important. But it hasn't been talked, it's not mentioned much anymore, and I want to show you why here in a few minutes. But bear with me. M3 includes M2 plus euro dollars plus large time deposits. There are other things in here too. You can break it down. This class, I don't want you to have tons of the idiotic details and all that. Bear with me a moment here. I want to show you something here. Oh, dig. Well, that helped. Okay. hey, this is working now. Sweet. Okay, bear with me. Now, I've assigned and I'm putting up web links to articles that I have written over the past 10 years or so. The money supply is important because money, the more money there is, as the supply of money goes up, the price of money goes down. The price of money is interest rates. That's what the, it's actually not a price, it's a rental rate. Really, you don't have a price, but you have a rental rate. I can rent you for an hour, big boy. but I can't buy you. I mean, we don't have slavery anymore, although you would be a fine slave, don't get me wrong. But all I can do is rent you. So in a sense, when we talk about prices, really a lot of times, what you'll hear me say the word price, but I'm using it very loosely. What I'm really referring to is a rental rate. So when I talk about the price of money, what I'm really talking about is a rental rate. And what is that? That's an interest rate. I rent money for a while, I pay an interest rate on it. So the price of money is the interest rate. So as the supply of money increases, the interest rate, the rental rate on money, should fall. Conversely, if the supply of money contracts, then the rental rate should go up on it. The interest rate should rise. That's the basis of Federal Reserve monetary policy. Controlling the money supply is concomitant with changing and controlling interest rates. Now bear with me, I'm going to show you something here about the M's. Stupid small print. Really? I can't even see that. Okay. Give me one second here. I'm going to take you somewhere. Okay. And let me take you here. Well, you know, I really would like that. Find. Now, to explain to you what's going on here, in the, and I've said this, I've explained this before, in the period starting about the mid-2000, 2004, 2005, I started writing articles on my financial economics website warning that we were on a collision course with a very bad time. I wrote various articles, and then I wrote a series called The Economics of Wreckage, where I was showing data indicating that there was a severe growing problem in our economy with the amount of investment, with the growth of, with the value of stocks. In fact, during the period after, from about 2001 on forward, holding well-diversified portfolios, whether you were holding high-risk, medium-risk, or low-risk portfolios, in real terms, you were losing money. You were actually, the stock markets were in negative growth for quite a few years. And I said, this is clearly symbolic of something severe under the surface. And all these tax cuts that had happened that were depleting the government, wiped out our budget surpluses, you can't get by with that without something else going on. And that something else was that we were borrowing money like a bandit. We were buying cheap stuff from overseas, so we were exporting dollars that those foreign countries like China were coming back here and lending us. And we were also printing money at an insane rate. Understand this. There is one and only one cause of inflation. Inflation cannot be caused, for example, by raising the minimum wage. Inflation cannot be caused by greedy corporations jacking up their profits. Inflation cannot be caused by evil unions or greedy corporations. Those cannot create inflation. One and only one thing creates inflation, that is the money supply growth rate exceeding the real growth rate of the economy's need for it. Again, inflation can only happen if the real growth rate of the economy is not as fast as the growth rate of the money supply. This goes back to the original mission of the Federal Reserve, which was to grow the money supply, watch it, and carefully, meticulously make the money supply grow just at the rate that a growing economy would need more money, more liquidity. You've got more people, more businesses. We would grow the money supply by just enough to accommodate this. If you grow it by more than that, all you're going to get in the long run is inflation. In the short run, you can actually create like a false punch effect. People and businesses feel like they've got extra money so that you get a rapid growth. This is what we did over periods of time in recessions. We print the money faster than the economy needed it, just to make the economy feel better, and then we would quickly claw back in that excess liquidity before it created inflation. Other countries, they couldn't control themselves. They just kept printing and printing money, and they got into a death spiral. We did that in the 1960s and 70s. We broke that death spiral, crushed the money supply, drove ourselves into a recession, and then we learned our lesson. China, for quite a few years, has just been printing money at an insane rate, partly, mostly, just to keep its stuff cheap in overseas markets. It was probably, by an estimate that I provided that was based upon Japanese researchers' estimate, the Chinese prices were about a third of what they should have been, based upon purchasing power parity. But that's speculative at this point in its old history. But what is the reality of it is that our Federal Reserve has a job. The mission originally charged to the Fed in terms of conducting monetary policy was to maintain aggregate price level stability. In other words, no inflations, no deflations. Grow the money supply at just the right rate. Do it. Don't listen to politicians who are crying for, oh, we've got to have the money supply grow faster so we can boost the economy so I can get elected again. None of that. That's why we made the Fed independent, is so that they would not pander to the needs of politicians. So let's go and look at the history of the world, at least the history of the money supply in the United States, since the year 2000. You notice that I've got marked there very clearly that the Federal Reserve stopped publishing M3. It said in an official release at the time that in March of 2006 that no one needs to know that. It's not useful. Economists don't care about it. So we won't do that anymore. We won't publish that anymore. What do you see what's happening to M3? What do you see there in that graph, the red line? Like a maniac, just insanely going up. But at the same time, M1, the money that people and businesses, households and companies use. M1, transaction liquid money. What was happening to that, its growth rate? Nearly zero. It was clear the Fed was starving out the base of the economy. The growth of the economy was still 2 to 3%. The growth of the money supply that supports that economy was zero. On average. You see it right there. The data is clear. There was a disliquidification of the real life markets of businesses and households. We didn't have enough money. We were starved down in money. But M2 was growing. Now, you notice that if M1 is flat in growth, that would mean that the small time deposits and now accounts were growing fast. But M3 was growing at an insane rate. By the time I stopped doing the publishing that data, when this article was written, right before the catastrophe happened, I wrote one last article called The Gospel of Impending Doom. I just said, here's what's going to happen. I wrote that in May, or I think it was May or June, something like that, of 2008. You're on your own now. The growth rate was approaching 17% on M3. But M1 wasn't growing. M2 was growing at maybe 5%. So almost all of that growth, that mad, insane growth of M3, highly illiquid money, was coming from the highly illiquid part of M3. Because the liquid parts, M1 was growing not at all, M2 was growing modestly, M3 was growing at an extraordinary rate. So what was that all about? What the hell was causing that insane growth that the Federal Reserve wanted to shut down our knowledge of? They shut it down. There were some fabulous websites like John Williams' Shadow Government Statistics that were still putting the numbers together. That's where I got the numbers for this graph from John. I can't imagine how hard it was to actually still put together M3 after the Fed stopped publishing it. Okay, M3 would have been euro dollars and large time deposits. Euro dollars are American dollars that we have spent on foreign products. Those dollars end up in foreign reserves of central banks around the world. That was indeed growing at an extremely fast pace, the amount of money that was accumulating in the People's Bank of China, because we were buying their cheap products at a very, very fast pace. So we were exporting American dollars to get the cheap products. So yeah, that would have been part of it. That couldn't have been all of it. The rest of it was these massive, huge, highly illiquid deposits here and around the world. And here's where the problem came in. You see, banks, brokerage houses, it's great when they have this tier 2, tier 3 stuff on their books, but tier 1 is how you pay your bills, your light bill, your wages and salaries, your NOMs. All of those things are paid with M1 money. M1 money wasn't growing. So what happened? The brokerage houses, the banks, others started taking highly illiquid securities and writing side bets on them. Swaps, derivatives, financial gaming instruments, because they could back them with the highly illiquid stuff, and they could sell them to get fast little bits of liquid cash. It'd be like you have a house, you're desperate for money, it's a big asset, so you start writing options on your house. You start writing derivatives, you start writing bets. And then when the house loses all of its value, which is what happened with the housing market, the side bets fall to zero. That was what happened with the credit derivative market. You see, the thought of there being some evil force that was writing these credit derivative swaps, there was actually a logical, rational survival action going on. Underneath the surface, the economy was being starved of the money that you use for your bills. So people were borrowing on their credit cards. People were taking out second, third, fourth mortgages on their houses. Banks, brokerage houses were writing all kinds of exotic derivative instruments and selling them to suckers to have money just for the purpose of paying bills, because the money supply that you would normally have that happen with was not growing, even though the economy was continuing to grow. And when you have a situation like that, sooner or later, you're going to have what happened. So there you are. That is, in a nutshell, the backdrop of how we got, part of the reason we got to where we got. You can talk about bank regulation, which was extraordinarily lax, all you want. But at the same time, the operations of the Federal Reserve, I mean, it's thank God there wasn't any bank regulation, because then the banks would have failed much faster. People would have gone into bankruptcy much more quickly. As it was, we could write these side instruments, second, third, fourth mortgages, derivatives, and all that, and we could keep going. And we did as long as we could until the global financial markets just simply broke under the pressure of all of this stuff that was out there that didn't have a sufficient base in real assets behind it. Anyway, enough of that part of it. Now I take you to the next part. Let me kill this off. And I will all provide you with a couple of articles you can read so that you can go through and do this a little more slowly in your own time. I do caution that it gets a little bit intense. And so, excuse me. What is wrong with me today? I do caution that it takes sometimes a couple of times reading through these. If you can't get it the first time you read one of these articles, yeah, that doesn't mean you're not smart. It just means that you're pretty normal. You have to read it a couple of times to get the idea of it. But let me take you through, how does the Fed create money, print money? First of all, the Fed is an agent of the United States Treasury. Its agency is for the purpose of printing the money that is the government's debt, the part that is owed, that is owned by the Federal Reserve, which lends the government money. Basically, the Federal Reserve can go to a Treasury auction and buy government debt instruments. In other words, the Federal Reserve, an agency of the government, can lend the government money. Follow me on that again. Let's try that again. The Federal Reserve, an agency of the federal government, can print money and go to a Treasury auction and buy government debt instruments, thereby lending the government money. In other words, the government can lend itself money. How does it do it? It prints money to do it. That's what you have in your pockets, those greenbacks and those coins. Those are the ultimate evidence that the Fed has walked to a Treasury auction and lent the government money for its operations. That's what the money is. Essentially, it is nothing but the Federal Reserve saying, look, we printed this, we went to the Treasury, and we bought some of what the government needed to borrow with this, and now you've got it. We printed this up for you to have to show that we're on the job lending the government money. Now imagine if you had bills and you printed some money up and paid the bills with that money that you printed. Wouldn't that be nice? Okay, you would be some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility if you did that. That's exactly what the government does through the Federal Reserve. It's not conspiracy theory or anything like that. That's just how it works. The Federal Reserve prints money, and then it uses that money to lend the government money, because the government can't pay all of its bills with tax revenues because we spend too much and we tax too low. That's just what we've been doing for, about 12 years now, 11 years now. We've been doing that. We did it at other times in history with surprisingly sad results. And eventually we'll get to that now, although it seems like it's more of a slow bleeding drain these days. But let's talk about how the government operates with open market operations here. OMOs. Now, I'll remind you of a few details about the Federal Reserve as we go along here. But let's say that the government wanted to expand the money supply. It wanted to provide liquidity to the economy. It wanted to do quantitative easing. Have any of you heard that term, quantitative easing? It's a fancy term for the Fed is going to shovel money into the economy to make you feel good. You're dying of cancer. It's a really bad one. It's going to eat you. You're going to be miserable. You're going to bitch and cry and all that. But here's a big pile, like $1 million. Won't that make you feel better for a while?
For a while?
Yeah, sure it will. You were engaged to a gorgeous princess of an Arabian country. Or not. You were engaged to a gorgeous princess of a Transylvanian sovereign kingdom. But unfortunately, the king, and you're so much in love, you float in fields, you pick flowers and sniff them. But I'm the king, and I come up to you, and I was going to say yes to this, but now Olaf here, his father, I need an alliance with him, so go away. God. You're about to kill yourself. Oh, shut up. Here's a couple bags of gold. There's probably about $10 million there. Go home. Now, are you still sad? Well, yeah, you are. You loved her, but man, that is going to buy you a Mercedes and a Porsche. You can get something else. Yes, you can. Okay? Money makes us feel better when we're sad. Don't tell me money doesn't buy happiness. That's a lie. Dude, you go to the mall with money, I'm happy afterwards. Cheesecake Factory? A couple of Armani suits? Yeah. Money doesn't buy happiness, my ass. God. What the hell? Where did they get that? Probably some poverty-stricken monk living in Tibet. You've never had red velvet cheesecake, have you, monk? Okay. Okay, so we're going to expand the money supply because the economy doesn't feel good. The economy's really emo, and we're afraid it's going to go and get some tats and some piercings, you know, and all that. So we're going to expand the money supply. Here's how it works. Within the Fed are a bunch of committees. This hugely important one is called the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. This is the big 800-pound gorilla of decision-making bodies on monetary policy. The FOMC comprises the seven governors are always permanent voting members on whether we're going to increase or decrease the money supply, all that. And then there are five bank presidents from the districts. From the districts, there are five bank presidents. Now, four of those serve on two-year terms, rotating two-year terms. So you might have the bank president from the Atlanta Fed district there for 2 years, then he would yield to the bank president from the San Francisco. So over time, these four bank presidents seat themselves for 2 years, and then they give way to another district bank president. One of them is permanent. The one that is permanent is the president of the New York District Bank. The Empire Bank president has a permanent voting seat. That's, by the way, I think I already mentioned, maybe I didn't. It's called the Empire Bank. The Empire Bank president has a permanent voting seat on the Fed. You'll see why in a minute. As a side historical note, during the run-up to the incredible crisis in 2008, the New York Fed president sat on his fat ass at the epicenter of hell, boiling up out of the ground, and he was not doing much of anything. His name was Timothy Geithner. Now, does anyone by any chance know, after he served at the Fed as the bank president of the Empire Bank, does anyone know what Timothy Geithner went on to do after that? He was appointed by our current president as the Secretary of the Treasury. The same twerp that was at the epicenter of financial nuclear holocaust went on and got rewarded for being an idiot by being our Treasury Secretary of the United States of America. I wrote a scathing, vicious, cruel article. Timothy Geithner is actually about 5'3" tall. And I pointed out that he was short on knowledge. He was dwarfed by his peers. And for some reason, they thought that was unfair of me, hurtful. Oh, I am sorry, Mr. Geithner, you midget. You nearly bring the world to apocalypse, and I can't point out the fact that you're a short man. Anyway, that's that pain that comes in my temple. Okay, here, watch. Okay, the FOMC meets, and they vote. Do we raise interest rates, raise the discount rate? Do we lower the discount rate as a signal? What do we target the federal funds rate at? All that. And then they say, okay, this means we are going to expand the money supply, contract the money supply. Now, at any one of these meetings, you're going to have a diversity of opinions. You have bank presidents. Some of the bank presidents are total inflation hawks. Print more money? Are you nuts? No. They'd say that if we were dying. You know, they're really against the whole idea of the Fed helping the economy or slowing down the economy. They have this mentality, we need to stay a course and stop trying to be friends to business and people and politicians and right-wingers and liberals. We need to stop doing that. We need to grow the money supply at the real growth rate of the economy. They are the minority in most eras, especially these days, because the dominant force is always the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He's the point man. And our current chairman, Ben Bernanke, is a man who is highly politically sensitive. He wants to be liked specifically by the president. Now, in a lot of eras, we have plenty of evidence that Fed chairmen have acted at times near elections to make the economy suck if a Democrat were in office or win if a Republican were in office. We have plenty of evidence of that, that Fed chairmen try to use monetary policy to get Republican presidents elected. We know that happens. That's just the reality of it. But we also know that over a longer course of time, that they generally tend to try to resist the kind of pressure that comes from politicians. Paul Volcker was a great example of that. Jimmy Carter appointed him to do a job. He did the job, which necessitated literally wrecking the economy to stop the inflation, knowing full well that that would get the man who would put him in there in that position kicked out of office. He did it anyway. The president who did that knew it was going to happen. That's just the reality of it. But our current chairman, Ben Bernanke, is highly sensitive. And it's not just because he wants to be liked. He also needs defenders because there is a growing voice in Congress among right-wingers and conservatives, and even some Democrats, that the Federal Reserve's independence has gone too far, and for the first time in history, the Federal Reserve needs a full complete audit of all of its operations. That's never happened with the Fed. It scares the hell out of the Fed. Partly because it would be the end of Federal Reserve independence. Part of it because it's very possible that they could pull a lot of skeletons out of the closet. But one way or the other, Ben Bernanke wants to stay as close as he can to friendship with the current president and the White House, and more moderate and liberal forces in Congress to hold back that tide calling for the audit. Let me move on now to what's going to happen here. Now, I want you to remember a rule that I gave you the last time. I showed you. When the price of a security goes up, its yield goes down. Remember I showed you that with Treasury bills. It's true of all securities. Holding everything else constant, increasing price decreases yield. You need to remember that for what I'm about to show you, how open market operations work. And if you think this is trivial, these open market operations are occurring to the tune of billions and billions of dollars every day. This is the most massive government program of managing the economy, bar none. Jobs programs, tax cuts, tax increases are nothing compared to the volume of money that is happening day in and day out in open market operations, OMOs. So, the Federal Reserve has determined that we want to expand the money supply. This vote is taken in secret, and then the result of that is carried by the Empire Bank president back to the Empire Bank in New York City. Now, the reason the Empire Bank has a permanent seat and the reason that the New York bank president, district bank president, is carrying these marching orders is because it is at the Empire Bank that the domestic trading desk sits. And I know I've gone through some of this before, and I'm just repeating. I'm making sure that you know how this works. And it's also in an article. I'm going to put a link to an article, The Federal Reserve Under Fire, Part 1, that you can read. You'll see how this works there, too, and the video also explains it a little bit, but not in too much detail. The domestic trading desk is not a desk like one of those put-together-yourself solder desks you buy at Walmart or Target. No. When we say desk, we are referring to an ocean of traders. Government bond, securities traders. They are at their desks, each one of them. The desk manager gets the marching orders from the Fed district bank president. He talks to the Fed manager. They plan the strategy, and then they send the marching orders out to the vast ocean of traders. Now, you are about to become a trader at the Fed, okay? Here's a great thing about doing that job, and there are many, many of these. I've had a couple of students do this, that actually went on to do this in their life work. You have a portfolio right there in front of you. It's not physical anymore, but it's still there. You have a portfolio of the two most liquid assets in the world. You have as much of them as you want. You have a pile of dollar bills, dollars, and you have a pile of treasury bills. You have both of these. This is your portfolio. Highly liquid on both ends of it. There's only one difference. I can buy NOMs with a dollar. I can't buy anything with a T-bill. In other words, they are perfect substitutes for each other, except that dollars, I can use treasury bills I would have to hold. And you've got both of these. So you're a desk trader. Here's your desk. This is a desk trader. You have dollar bills, as many as you want. Now, don't try to take them off premises, really. You know, leave them there. And you also have T-bills that the Fed has bought and put into your account, your professional account. Now, let's go out here and look at the open market. I'm a bank. I'm a bank president. Now, a bank has a variety of assets. The crucial assets in terms of liquidity are what we call its tier, loosely, what you would call tier one assets. The tier one assets, not surprisingly, are dollar bills and T-bills. Tier one assets. It's safest, most liquid assets. And I'm a bank. I got both of these. Now, I also have a lot of other assets that aren't as liquid. M2s, M3 types of money. But this is my liquid stuff here. Now, one thing that I want to bring up here right now is that these dollars are actually parked in this vast ocean of all bank money accounts called the federal funds market. All the banks, in a virtual sense, there is this Fed funds market, this vast reserve where all the banks keep their respective dollar accounts. Fed funds market. This is the pool of money the banks borrow from each other. And really, at the base of it, this is where all the money is that gets lent out for cars and all that kind of stuff and homes. That's overstating it a lot. But really, this is a vast pool of trillions of dollars. And it comprises the bank accounts of all the different banks everywhere and all times. So I've got my little stash of my money, my tier one dollars in here. I got my stash of T-bills in the vault or maybe in an electronic account somewhere. Now, you are a trader, sir. You have been given marching orders that you need to pump money into the economy. I am the one you're going to do it through. You need me to take money from you. What do you have? What do I have that you could buy from me in exchange for dollars that is as liquid as dollars? What do I have that you could buy? Yes. So here's what you would do to me. You would call me on the phone. Ring, ring. And I answer, yeah, what do you want? I'd like to buy a T-bill and give you money for the T-bill. You got T-bills? Yeah, I got T-bills. Okay, I want to buy one. Okay, what do you want to pay me for it? $950? Go to hell. Click. Well, that certainly sucked. I like my T-bills. You can bite me. I'm not going to sell my T-bills. I'm not going to do that. But remember, you have to face the desk manager. And the desk manager is very, very big. Her name is Bertha. Bertha Butt. And she'll hurt you if you don't do the job. You've got to get it done. What are you going to do? Call me back. Okay, ring, ring. Hello. And you say, it's me again. Yeah, what do you want? Come on, tell me what you're going to do. Work it.
960.
Oh, you did, yeah. 960? Go to hell. But you were right. You were exactly right. So you come back at me again. Ring, ring. Hello, what do you want? You want to buy one of my T-bills. Come at me.
961.
961. What the hell are you talking? Are you out of your mind? I'm Jewish. You're not. Stop that. But you see what's happening? He's bidding the price of the T-bill up. What does that do to the interest rate on the T-bill, the yield on the T-bill? It drives it down. Well, spank me, Jesus. He's bringing down T-bill rates. I buy it. Fine, 970. So I send you a T-bill, and you put another dollar into the federal funds market. So here comes the second wave. You have increased the liquidity in the federal funds market, but there's even more to it than that. This federal funds market is the lendable funds market. Lendable funds. On any given day, there is a supply of funds and there's a demand for funds. And there is a federal funds rate that is the equilibrium for that day. But if you deposit money in my name into that federal funds market, what happens in the supply and demand framework if suddenly he puts more money in and every desk trader puts more money in? What's going to happen? Which one of these curves is going to shift? Supply. The supply of lendable funds goes from S0 out to S1, so the federal funds rate, even though the Fed can't set it, it can make it go down. So the Fed is doing a bunch of things. One is it's bringing down the yields on T-bills, which brings down the cost of government borrowing, which brings down the cost of all business borrowing. The Fed is putting money into the banks so that they can lend money more. They got more money to lend. And the federal funds rate at which banks can lend to each other and ultimately to the public is going down. The money supply is expanding, and you have accomplished the goal of trying to boost the economy by increasing the money supply and driving interest rates down. That's all I have for you. I thank you.